Welcome to Wednesday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live here on Giants.com. He is Paul Dottino. I'm Lance Medow with you for the next 60 minutes as we will continue to recap the Giants' final game of the season against the Green Bay Packers. We'll go over some of the highlights from the pressers for Jerry Reese and Ben McAdoo. And today we're going to give out some season awards as we look back at some of the impressive performances across the board. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number. Hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter. We'll get to your tweets as well. And Paul, let's start with the pressers. Ben McAdoo and Jerry Reese both addressed the media on Tuesday, on Monday,
yeah,
where they basically gave their season outlook and perhaps what the addresses that they will have to go about their business with respect to the offseason, player personnel, and so forth. But what jumped out to you just out of curiosity in terms of perhaps what Jerry Reese or Ben McAdoo had to say?
Well, I think when you're talking about Jerry Reese, the one thing that a lot of people have certainly stuck to is the phrase that he used when talking about Eric Flowers. And that was that this is the first time I've heard Jerry Reese talk about his young offensive lineman and not seal him in or glue him in as the left tackle. He did say that he thinks Flowers still has the potential and the talent to be a stud offensive lineman, but it may be at another position. Jerry has never moved off of the left tackle thing since he got here. We think he's a left tackle. He's going to be the left tackle. He left the door open there as a possible moving of the lineman. I thought that was the thing that I took from Jerry the most. In terms of Ben, I think the thing I took from him was he appreciated all the improvement that this team made, obviously, 11 wins and getting into the playoffs. But this guy, he's determined. He is really determined to make this step one. He was already telling us on Monday, he's ready for next season already.
Yeah, he's hungry.
Yeah, he's real hungry. This is a guy who, in his rookie season as a head coach, won 11 games and made the playoffs, and he is foaming at the mouth and chomping at the bit to get started for next season already. He's not drained by it, and if he is, he's not telling anybody. He certainly doesn't look like he's worn out, at least not to me.
No, not at all.
He looks like he is ready to go for another 20 games. And, you know, I do appreciate that because this season does take a lot out of you. And for this guy to have the kind of gusto that he has to want to really start next season already today, that was a good sign for me. It was a very positive, energetic type of sign and one that makes you want to jump ahead and look forward. And I thought that was good because he was not in a woes is me mentality. Oh, we didn't play well. We didn't put our best game on the field in Green Bay. Boy, I really regret that. It's such a shame. No, that was not the case at all. And it would have been easy for him to do that and say, we didn't play well. You know, Green Bay outplayed us and we lost. And I really feel disappointed how we ended the season because I know our team's better than that. He didn't reflect that at all. He was just, let's keep going forward. Let's keep this train moving. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, and now that the season's over, I think it's also interesting to put what Ben McAdoo accomplished in perspective. First of all, it's very difficult first year as a head coach to get the team to the playoffs in year number one. That does not happen very often. Now, if you look at the league as a whole, this season, Paul, you had five new first-year head coaches in
yes.
the NFL. Three helped their teams get to winning records. Two helped them get to the postseason. It was Ben McAdoo and the Giants in the NFC, and it was Adam Gase and the Miami Dolphins
Correct.
In the AFC. The Dolphins won 10 games. The Giants won 11 games. So you see how rare it is, but both of those teams were obviously going through transition from how they performed the previous season. And I think both teams, if you build some parallels, made strides, whether it be the Giants on the defensive end and the Dolphins on the offensive end, given their running game issues and their mm-hmm. offensive line issues. But, you know, Adam Gase and Ben McAdoo in particular, no head coaching experience for either one of them. They were both known as coordinators. So this was really baptism by fire by both of them. And, you know, I think that says a lot. Plus, Ben McAdoo was the first Giants first-year head coach to get the team to the playoffs since Jim Fassel in year one, and then he was the first head coach to post an 11-win record since Dan Reeves in 1993.
Correct.
So that also puts things in perspective somewhat.
Now, off the field, I thought it was clear that both Reese and McAdoo, and then even Eli Manning in the locker room, all addressed Odell Beckham Jr. and said that he needs to continue his maturing process and needs to polish up a lot of these things that have, you know, kind of, I don't want to say littered, but have certainly caused some worry and concern.
Well, and have taken away from football, essentially.
Yeah. You know, so that was unanimous, whether it was McAdoo, Reese, or Manning. It was unanimous that in year four of Odell Beckham Jr.'s career, the Giants really want to see him, you know, mature into a full-fledged, all-around polished pro and get rid of all these little rough spots that seem to be affecting the perception of what this guy is all about.
The other thing that I found interesting out of the press conferences was what Jerry Reese answered when he was asked about the fullback position. And we've talked a lot about that, Paul, throughout the course of the season. I know fans were wondering why they never maybe brought somebody else in after Will Johnson got banged up and was put on IR. And Jerry Reese said, and I'm paraphrasing it, he said when they evaluated the role that the fullback was going to play in the offense, they realized that there was really only about five or six plays in which the fullback would get on the field. So when they broke down their needs, they felt that they could get away with not having a fullback since in their minds, it wasn't going to play a prevalent role on offense.
We had talked about that at the beginning of the season, and I wasn't a big fan of that because I am a power running game guy. And I do believe that ultimately it did come back to bite the Giants myself. I would like to see them have a fullback on the roster. And again, you're right. Looking at the playbook as it was constructed, there wasn't much room for a fullback. And so when the injuries occurred to Whitlock, and then, of course, he was suspended anyway.
Yeah.
But and then Will Johnson, it was like, okay, let's move forward, and we'll just go with the three receivers as the base package. Well, I think when you reevaluate that situation, you realize how important a fullback is. Now, the good news is this. They don't necessarily have to go out and get one. Will Johnson is signed through next season.
Bring him back.
And you expect that he's going to be healthy and be able to fulfill that role. I don't know that you have to go shopping for a fullback. He may already be on the roster, just being able to get Johnson off of IR.
Now, also in terms of personnel, Jerry Reese was asked about Eli Manning and the outlook for the remainder of his career. Now, he recently did sign an extension, and whether or not they would start to think about grooming a successor, bringing in another quarterback, just to lay out the roster. Ryan Nassib and Josh Johnson are both set to be free agents this offseason. So other than Eli Manning, the rest of the depth chart, it's up in the air in terms of whether or not those players will return. There is, I think, certainly room to pursue somebody in the draft as well as free agency. But in terms of the immediacy or the necessity to find a successor in 2017, Paul, at least personally, I don't think it's there right now. I think there's plenty of gas in the tank for Eli Manning. I think this is the time you want to probably start thinking about it, just like the Patriots did with Jimmy Garoppolo and Jacoby Brissett, as Tom Brady gets to 40, and Eli Manning is not as close to Tom Brady to 40, but he is getting up there. I don't know if the urgency is there, but if they feel that somebody in the mid-rounds may have some potential, there's no crime in perhaps drafting a quarterback this year.
I agree with you. I think this is the year now where you seriously have to consider it. And if the opportunity does present itself somewhere in the mid-rounds where somebody is sitting there who you really like and you say to yourself, well, you know what? This guy really looks like he could be something. For example, when the Cowboys wound up taking Prescott, you know, I know they didn't think he was going to be this good, but he was a guy who they felt was a legitimate prospect, and he was sitting there, and you say to yourself, okay, you know what? He's legit. I think we could take a shot at this guy. If the circumstances arise to where there's someone in the middle rounds, I would not be adverse to taking one. However, short of that, if they don't have belief in one of those middle-round prospects that the guy could be legit, then I would say don't bother. Don't push it. Don't force it. And then sign, for example, some of the veterans are available. Kellen Clemens, Blaine Gabbert. You know, there are some probably low- to medium-priced veterans they could sign for a year that will be on the free agent market, who could babysit for a year, and you could extend it one more year in terms of your search for the next young future Giants quarterback. I don't think you need to force it, is what I'm saying.
No, I agree with you. I don't think you need to reach it at this point, but there's no harm in having the conversation to start thinking about it. Eli Manning is under contract through the 2019 season. So at this point, I don't think it's necessarily priority number one, and there's no guarantee, Paul, that was the last contract for Eli Manning. Lance Medow, Paul Dottino with you here. What we want to do now is we want to give out some end-of-the-season awards as you look back at all of the accomplishments, whether it be plays, whether it be individual players. I think it's nice to certainly reflect at this point of the year. So, Paul, we put together a number of different categories. Let's run through them, and then obviously we'll both chime in terms of who we think is worthy of the award. Let's start with the most valuable player on offense in the 2016 season, and certainly a number of candidates that you could bring to the forefront. I'll let you start, and whether or not I agree, I'll give you confirmation, or else maybe I'll go into a different direction. So who stood out to you on offense in 2016?
Well, it would be impossible not to talk about Odell Beckham Jr. as the MVP, because he is a true game changer. I understand that there were a couple of throws every once in a while that you wish he had had, and because he raised the bar so high, you expect him to catch everything. The guy caught over 100 passes this year, and I think what happens is you sometimes forget how many times he was targeted and then how many he caught, and you just think sometimes when you reflect on disappointments of the ones that he dropped. It should not take away from the fact that he had a phenomenal season. And, you know, career high, finally broke the 100 catch mark.
Yeah, first to do that since Steve Smith, who had 107, which is the franchise mark. He also became the fifth player in NFL history to have at least 10 receptions for touchdowns plus 1,000 receiving yards in a single season for the first three campaigns. So that is pretty impressive when you look across the board. And let's also not forget, you know, game-winning touchdowns against the Baltimore Ravens and the Dallas Cowboys the second time around. He doesn't make those plays. Who knows how those games turn out?
Sure.
As far as the MVP on defense is concerned, I'll start here, Paul. The guy that I'm going to go with is Damon Snacks Harrison, because I think the entire defensive line fed off of what he brought to the forefront in terms of his ability to stop the run. The Giants dramatically turned things around in terms of their run defense. They were 24th against the run in 2015. They finished tied for third this season. And also, what I think was a pleasant surprise was the fact that Damon Snacks Harrison actually set a career high in sacks this season with 2.5. Now, nobody necessarily was thinking he was going to get about 10, but he actually was able to bring about some pressure up the gut and help collapse the pocket to get to the quarterback. So that, to me, was an added bonus, but he was the anchor, and everybody else, to me, fed off of his play this season.
To me, there are co-defensive MVPs, because I think Landon Collins has to be
certainly
given an award here, and I just can't leave him off. So, you know, you look at Collins. I'm looking at the number now, and I was unaware that the final number actually came to 125 for his tackles, which meant he was two tackles behind Cyprian from Jacksonville as the number two tackler in the National Football League in terms of defensive backs. Can't say enough about what Landon Collins did. Develop ball skills. You know, we saw the consecutive game streak of interceptions when he had five games in a row with picks. We saw him improve against the run as if that was possible, because he was pretty good last year. We saw his awareness on the field improve dramatically. We saw him basically take on the role of a leader back there as the safety of that secondary. And I see no reason why he won't even get better next year, to be perfectly honest with you. And he was already first-team All-Pro. I mean, I can't say enough about him. And, you know, in retrospect now, did the Giants do the right thing when they traded up to get that second-round pick so that they could snag Landon Collins last year? Oh, I think so.
And given all the injuries, also provided stability at that position, too. So that's why he certainly proved very valuable. Landon Collins is going to be a selection for another award coming up. That's why I saved him, but I don't think you go wrong in naming him MVP. On offense, most improved player on offense. Now, this is a difficult one when you look at the landscape. They had some injuries on offense, but somebody that perhaps made a jump from last season to 2016.
Well, to me, this one is really easy also, because Bobby Hart started 12 games this year on that offensive line. And you know what? He did okay. I mean, he wasn't all pro. He wasn't locked down great. But Bobby Hart was okay. And we only saw flashes of him as a rookie at the very end of the season. Recall when he got thrown into the lineup
there opportunity
because of injuries. And it was like, all right, this guy's a seventh-round pick out of Florida State. He's a big guy, played on a great program. Maybe he's got something. There's some flashes there, but who knows? Well, this year he started 12 games, and he was okay. He's proven he belongs in the National Football League. There's no question about it. Now, whether or not you think he should be a starter for 16, you could argue that if you want to, if you can find somebody who's significantly better. There's nothing wrong, though, with Bobby Hart being your backup, because if he's your backup, that's pretty good.
Well, it's similar to Landon Collins. The experience that he's gained in about a year and a half, because like you said, he was thrown into the fire a little late season as a rookie, is only going to help him moving forward because of the reps and the experience going up against defensive ends and so forth. So I think you got to take that into consideration. I'm with you. He, to me, is my choice for most improved on offense. Considering some of the injuries they suffered on the offensive line, the fact that he was able to remain durable at least until the end of the year when he dealt with the forearm injury and certainly gained some valuable reps, I think that's key. And it'll be very important this offseason to see if he can now take an additional step depending on who they bring in the offseason for further competition. Most improved on defense, and that's who I was saving for Landon Collins, given the jump that he made from 2015 to 2016.
A worthy pick.
Worthy indeed. I mean, who else jumps ahead of you? I know you're going to be able to make a selection, but I mean, it's remarkable the strides that he made. And he'd be the first one to tell you that his rookie year was very, very up and down, but he started all 16 games. And this is why I emphasize this, just like when I was talking about Bobby Hart, the experience he got on the field as a rookie, learning the scheme, seeing what the scheme called for him to do, made him that much more prepared to make this lunge in 2016, and his ability to come down at the line of scrimmage and stop the run, make open field tackles was extremely impressive, but also some of the improvements he made down the field in terms of coverage, which was something that he had to obviously go through as a rookie, I thought was extremely important. And the numbers speak for themselves, the interceptions, the sacks, the pass deflections, and as you mentioned, Paul, making first team All-Pro. Hard to argue against Landon Collins not being the most improved player on defense.
See, for me, I will argue that because I'm going to go Jonathan Casillas.
This
is a guy who was voted co-captain, became truly one of the keynote leaders in that locker room, and for the first time in his eight-year career, he was a full-time starter and played on all three downs. And who would have thunk that? Because early in his career, he was simply a special teams player, and then a backup and a reserve, and then he was kind of worked in, you know, into sub-packages where he bounced around to different teams, had been on Super Bowl teams with the Saints, of course, and the Patriots, and had gotten, you know, rings with those clubs, comes to the Giants, and it's like, okay, he's going to be a great special teams player and a great sub-package player, and that's really all anybody thought he was going to be. And then this year, for the first time as a full-time starter, 96 tackles, second on the team to Collins, knocked down eight passes in terms of pass coverage, and a vocal presence in that locker room and on the field. You can't say much more than when the guy gets voted co-captain.
Helped fill the void in the absence of John Beeson and Antrel Roll in previous seasons. So that is something that I think gets overlooked. Lance Medow, Paul Dottino with you here. We're going over some of the end-of-the-season awards as we reflect on the 2016 campaign. Most impressive rookie from the 2016 class. There's a few that certainly come to the forefront. I'm going to go with Sterling Shepard. I think the opportunity that was presented for him in the early stages of the season was, hey, he could be part of a very dangerous trio with Victor Cruz and Odell Beckham. And if you look at his efficiency on third down, especially in the first four or five games of the season, through the roof, he finished with eight receiving touchdowns, which was second to Michael Thomas of the Saints amongst all rookie, no matter what the position was, for receiving scores. So I think when you take that into consideration, he had an opportunity to become a starter, to contribute immediately. I think he took full advantage of that and was, for the most part, consistent throughout the year.
Not only second among rookie wide receivers in touchdowns, but second among rookie wide receivers in catches and also in yardage receiving. Very hard to go off of him, although the late surge by Paul Perkins would make you hesitate. Perhaps even Andrew Adams, who, as an undrafted rookie free agent, wound up being a starting safety on this team. You know, you could certainly throw him into the conversation, but, I'm going to find it hard-pressed to move off of Sterling Shepard, too.
Most underrated player on the roster.
Oh, I'm going to save mine. You go ahead with yours.
You want to save yours?
I'm saving
mine. You're going to put me on the spot here.
I'm saving mine.
Wow. Here's one that I'm going to throw out, and he's a veteran, but I think what he was called upon to do proved extremely valuable. And I know he was inactive for a few games. I'm going to go with Leon Hall, because Leon Hall, moving him to safety, moving him to corner, the role he played, the versatility he played, enabled the Giants, when they dealt with some injuries, to feel, you know what, we could throw this guy into the mix, and he's going to provide us some stability. And when I think of underrated, I'm not looking for a guy whose numbers are jumping off the page necessarily. I'm looking for a guy that serves a role, is reliable, and they brought him in right before the start of training camp, even later in training camp, I should say, after he parted ways with the Cincinnati Bengals, and the Giants got good use out of him, even though he was inactive for a stretch. So, to me, Leon Hall is one of the most underrated players on this roster this year.
That's not a bad call. I'm going to go with Brad Wing. Even though he was a two-time NFC Special Teams Player of the Week, you know, he didn't get support for the Pro Bowl, did not get support for the All-NFL All-Pro team. And if you look at the overall stats amongst punters, he's in the middle of the pack with his stat line as you look at it across the board. But you and I know from watching this guy each and every Sunday, he was incredibly valuable to the Giants. And in fact, Coach Ben McAdoo, as far as saying several times during the year, he was a weapon. Weapon was the word that was used. You don't hear that often when talking about punters. So I'm going to say, even though he got some props and accolades, I'm going to say he was the most underrated.
No, that's fair. Listen, field position is so key. And what was the one thing we talked about in the Giants-Packers game? Field position. So if you can have a guy that can give you that advantage, it's hard to necessarily overlook that. All right, we got two more here. Player with the most potential. I'm going to go back to the rookie class, Paul, and the guy that I didn't give most impressive rookie to, I'm going to give the player with the most potential, and I think that's Paul Perkins. You can't overlook the surge that he had late in the season. He could eventually become the workhorse on this team. You look at his ability to run off the edge, the versatility that he can provide. He's improved in pass protection. I think he could even get more out of him as a receiver. I think the most potential by far is out of Paul Perkins on this roster.
This is a little difficult for me because I agree with you about Paul Perkins. I think he's going to be a really good player for several years to come. But remember, running backs are not workhorses these days. They're usually part of a pairing. And I think Paul Perkins is going to be a very important part, but the kind of guy who took advantage of Shane Vereen's absence. And I think that next year, when the Giants kind of reconfigure their running game, Paul Perkins is going to be a 15-carry a game kind of guy. He's not going to be a 25 carry a game kind of guy.
But 15 in this day and age is not bad.
It's not bad, and he's going to be a big, big part of what the Giants do. Please don't let me be misinterpreted here. I'm going to go back to Landon Collins because I think Landon Collins has the potential to be a multiple-time Pro Bowl player. I think defensively, safeties can often play 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years in this league. And some of the best guys are perennial All-Pros 5, 6, 7 years down the road. I'm going to take the word potential, and I'm not going to necessarily say a guy who's down here because of his inexperience and comes up. What I'm going to say is here's a guy here who has reached the heights of his game and is going to continue to do so for several years to come. So in that regard, I'm going to say that Collins has the potential to be a 6-time All-Pro. How about that?
It's all about how you interpret the category. But that's fair. Listen, it's hard to argue, like I said, based on the fact that we've given Landon Collins multiple awards here on this segment,
hey,
that he doesn't have potential.
For that same type of definition, you could easily go Beckham.
Of course, too, in terms of he not hitting his ceiling yet and could still perhaps even go higher and higher
could
based
be
on
how his many, numbers many year all pro.
All right, final category, best play of the season. Now, there are certainly a number of them on defense. Odell Beckham has plenty of them as well. I know there's one in particular on defense that has stood out to you.
Well, it's for me, it's got to be Collins' pick six in
He's
London
a big
against
theme
the Rams.
On this, you can tell.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I can't say enough about that play, and ESPN has their top 10 plays of the year as determined by Sports Science. And they ran that show, I guess it was a week or so ago. I just happened to turn it on and catch it when I think they were at play 8, which was Landon Collins. And as they replayed that interception, and they put the computer on him, and they measured out all his moves and his force and his speed and everything else, the thing that really hit me was that they said he ran over 97.5 yards to score that touchdown.
Covered
between all the zigzagging that he did. And then on top of that, He was hit with such force inside the 5-yard line by one of the Rams that he bounced into another Rams defender, who then made the tackle on him, and because of the inertia, he wound up moving forward because of the combination tackle and fell into the end zone and scored the touchdown. It was funny because had the initial hit not come with the force and at the angle that it had come with, he probably would have come down inside the 3 and not have scored. But because he was absolutely run into like a Mack truck, the force of that hit in combination with the assisted tackle helped him score. I thought that in itself was kind of fascinating when they broke it down on Sports Science.
It was like a pinball machine.
Exactly.
In terms of how he ricocheted into the end zone. I'm going to agree with you. While I could certainly make a case for Odell Beckham against the Ravens and Odell Beckham against the Cowboys, the reason why I can't get past the Landon Collins play, and I know this is not necessarily part of the criteria, but Paul, to me it was the turning point of the season.
Without question.
I mean, how could you get past that play?
You can't. You can't.
When then you look at what the defense did from that point on, the fact that they wanted to get above 500 mm-hmm. entering the bye following the trip to London, and it was a game where the offense struggled and needed the defense to do something just to energize the team. And then he also had an interception later in the game, which set up Rashad Jennings' go-ahead score. So, once again, there's certainly others that you can make a case for, but Landon Collins, the significance of the play, the athleticism, the science aspects of it, to me it's a home run for best play of the season.
Going into the bye week, too,
yeah.
which is also a critical stage of your year.
Lance Beto, Paul DeTito with you here on Giants.com. Those are our end-of-the-season awards. So glad you could join us here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. I know we've delved into a number of different topics. Those of you on the phones, we appreciate you waiting patiently. We're now going to open up the phone lines. And we want to hear from you, too, in terms of your end-of-the-season awards, all the categories that we just threw out. If you want to react to what Ben McAdoo and Jerry Reese said at the end-of-the-season pressers, as well as the Packers-Giants game, we can still very well discuss that as well. Let's begin the festivities with Marco in Connecticut. Marco, what's happening?
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Doing well, Marco. How's things with you?
I'm doing well. That was a good listen to hear those awards, and I may comment on them later on in the call. But first,
sure.
An off-season topic, and then I want to comment about what Jerry Reese had to say. What I'm really excited about with this off-season is there's going to be a lot of talk in the off-season after the Super Bowl, when all the teams are preparing for the new year. A lot of talk about the Giants, and most are going to point to the defense and the guys that really stuck out, like Collins. Collins is going to come out with a lot of, good PR. A lot of people are going to be pumping up the Giants defense. But what I think are a couple sleepers that, unless you're a big Giants fan, people that are not going to be talking about this, and I think we're going to jump out at other teams, Darian Thompson coming back, and Will Johnson coming back on offense. I think those two players who did not play, I don't think Thompson played I think he played in the first game maybe or the second game, but he really just lost the whole year. Will Johnson missed the whole year. And
it's a redshirt year essentially for him. That's the best way to
exactly.
look at it. This was a redshirt year
exactly.
for Darian Thompson.
Absolutely. And if you remember, Lance, Thompson was probably the most talked about rookie in preseason, like in the training camps. Everyone said that he was having the best training camp, and he was set up to start with Collins. So I'm just excited that these guys get to really jump out with no big expectations, except if you're a big Giants fan from the outside crowd. Here's what I want to talk about. And Reese and McAdoo and Eli, I mean, I was plugged in as ever. Listen to these guys. I thought Jerry was excellent. And Jerry usually doesn't give you much, but he was very open. And I appreciated that, especially coming off this tough loss. I feel like they gave permission now to talk about Odell. And here's what I'll say. And Paul, I agree with you, man. When you're talking about potential, this guy, I mean, there is no ceiling on him. The only ceiling on him is himself. And I'm not going to comment about everything that happened. I mean, there's really no point in talking about it. But here's what I want to – this is what I don't think gets brought up enough about Odell. And I would say it to Victor Cruz, because I don't think he handled this well this last 2 weeks – or this last week with the whole Miami thing. Odell, guys have been doing the things you're doing, they've been doing them forever. Now, they're not under the same lens that you're under. You're in a big city. You're the best at your position. You're just a juggernaut for attention, no doubt about it. But don't put it out there. Don't put it out there. Do your thing. But why did – if that picture never comes out, maybe it's talked about, maybe it's not. And maybe if they have a big game in Green Bay, nobody even cares anyways. But you – but because you put it on the map, it is not fair to listen to him or even listen to Victor after the game say, well, no matter what I do, it's going to be a distraction. Well, yes and no. You do it to yourself. Go look at Derek Jeter. Go look at Eli Manning. I mean, I know you guys are different, but there's a way to handle your business and there's a way not to. And it has nothing to do with what you're doing on the field. It's just how you put yourself in the limelight.
Eli Manning said something in front of his locker the other day that goes directly to your point, and he said you have to be aware of the perception that you're putting out there. And that's what
Absolutely.
You're talking about.
Absolutely. Paul, let me ask you this, and I'll listen offline. I've heard a couple comparisons lately, and I don't agree with this at all, with Beckham. Some people have compared him to Shockey, and when Shockey was with the Giants, and maybe how he was – groomed and dealt with, and then later it just didn't end up working out for a variety of reasons. I don't see it, but I'm not there. I don't know the guy, and to be honest with you, I think Beckham is on such a bigger platform than Shockey was. Do you think that's an appropriate comparison?
Two comments about this. Well, I would say, first of all, Shockey got to the point where at the end of his time here, he clearly wanted out and did not want to play here any longer, and was going to cause as much trouble as he could to get himself out of here. To my knowledge, Odell Beckham Jr. has never once uttered a breath or had an idea that he doesn't want to be here. So that's a big difference right off the top. Yeah. Second difference is, there's no question that even though Shockey was a big-time player, an all-pro, and a guy who was certainly well known and a lot of fans really liked him a lot, and he did great things for this organization, Odell Beckham Jr. is on a whole nother level. I mean, this guy is like beyond football. Not only is he a super duper awesome elite player at the top of his game, but he has become a sports celebrity much beyond what Shockey ever was. Even though Shockey was a star player, Beckham is way beyond that. So it's got some differences, although I certainly understand what you're saying, that because of the way he carries himself, there are rough spots there with both players. That's about where the similarities end for me.
Okay. All right. I everything I'm hearing about Odell, and I called a year ago, I talked to Lance and Jeff, and I asked Jeff specifically, and I was worried about the attention with this guy, and I was worried about how he handled it, and his kind of like his radar just seemed off to me. Like he very, very defensive, very, very protective in interviews and stuff, even when it didn't seem like people were necessarily coming at him. But again, it's hard to relate.
Here's what I will say. Go ahead. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Jeff Fiegel said the guy had the makeup of great family, great work ethic, great kid. Everything lined up for him to be, he's going to be okay. I got to say, a year later, I don't know. I really don't know. And to hear the general manager call him out the way that he did, it kind of put me at ease a little bit. Odell's got to know, although he is in a different league, he's not bigger than this team. He's not bigger than this team.
Nobody
is.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right, Marco.
I'll listen.
Appreciate the
phone
call. Thanks so much for chiming in.
One comment that should make you feel at least good about whatever situations Odell has to work through. He is an absolute football junkie who is a competitor to the 100th degree. And he absolutely loves the game and can't stand to lose. And I think if that is indeed his top priority as a person and as a player, that's always going to be the one thing that can get him on the straight and narrow and that can get him to round out whatever else he's got to fix. Because when that's your focus and that's the finish line, you will do what it takes to get there.
Well, and I think it's also important to look at the fact that if a player is getting a lot of attention in the media, how is it necessarily impacting the team on the field? And you really can't point to anything this season where it's impacted the team on the field, because early in the season, if you remember, a lot of people made a whole big deal about, you know, the emotions on the sideline, and I get that. But if you look at the amount of penalties that Odell Beckham picked up over the course of the season, Paul, you know, nothing really was immense where it impacted and hurt the team, where they were shooting themselves in the foot and constantly being
backed up. The one celebration touchdown.
Well, but I'm saying other than that, though. No, but if, I guess what my point is that if you look at 2016 as a whole and you didn't watch the games closely, you would think that Odell Beckham was picking up a penalty per game. And that it was
perception
truly,
again.
Yeah, but you know what? Perception in the media is one thing, and then the facts are a whole other thing.
No question.
And it's important to look at the facts
when
you talk about how a player impacts a team on the field. Perception, we can have an entire discussion about whether or not, you know, the emotions are in check. That's fine. But to me, that's a separate conversation than how the player is impacting the team on the field. And right now, the perception discussion is more about how the media and how the fans are perceiving Odell Beckham off the field. But at the end of the day, my point is it's a separate conversation in terms of how it's impacting the team. Field position, is it hurting the defense? Is it hurting the offense? Is it hurting the special teams? This is more about the conversation about the perception off the field, more so than on the field, is my point. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number, hashtag Giants Chat. Ken is in Trenton. Ken, what's happening?
Hey, Lance. Hey, Paul. How's it going, guys?
Good to talk to you.
Bear with me a little bit. I wasn't able to call and vent the other day. But particularly the wide receivers. Now, I defended them all week about that Miami trip. And in the back of my mind, I was always saying, if they don't play well, this is what we're going to be talking about for the whole offseason. I took it as a spit in the face, especially when before the game, you got your shirt off acting like you're invincible. And then you have the worst game of your career and the most important game of the season. I mean, I had to take a day off on Monday. I'm that kind of fan.
Ken, let me just say one thing to you, and I just think it's important to understand. Lynn Swann was one of the most spectacular wide receivers we've ever seen, and he played on what may be the greatest dynasty, that Steeler dynasty that, you know, the NFL has ever had. Did you know that twice during Lynn Swann's career, he was in a postseason that was one and done, and he only caught one ball in each of those two one and done scenarios? So does that mean that Lynn Swann was a bust and was a problem and, you know, was to blame for all of that?
No, I'm not saying that the Miami trip caused them to play bad. I'm saying all the publicity that it got throughout the entire week after that caused the entire team to play bad. Everybody on that team had to answer a question about
I think what you're doing, Ken, is I think you're giving the media a lot more credit than it needs to get, to be honest with you, where you're thinking that players are shifted to the newspapers and reading about the attention. They're not. I mean, here's another example that I want to use as a comparison. 2007. Tony Romo, if you remember, goes to Cabo during the bye week.
Yep.
The Cowboys had a bye. They were the top seed, and then they wound up playing the Giants. And I'm not bringing it up, and I'm not bringing it up to make a joke or anything. You're right. The Cowboys did lose. But if you go back to that game, Ken, do you really think that the Cowboys lost because Tony Romo took a bye week trip to Cabo? When, if you go back to that game, the Cowboys were plagued by penalties. Patrick Crayton had a drop off a slant. I'm not trying to make excuses why the Cowboys lost. The Giants played a good game, too. But the point is, there were mental mistakes by the Dallas Cowboys in that game, too. And it had nothing to do with Tony Romo going on a trip to Cabo.
I would only have one problem with that, Lance, and that is the quarterback is the leader of your team. And I think that he's held to a different standard than the other players on the team. So I think that what Romo did with his Cabo trip was not right, and I think it hurt the team, and I don't think it was a good idea because he is the leader of the team. His standard is higher than anybody else's. And the fact that he decided to party like he did and go out of town, look, you could say what it is you want. We can agree to disagree on this. But a receiver and a quarterback are not held to the same standard. The quarterback must be buttoned down 150% on everything that he does. So I do think it's different.
Well, I mean, I think Odell Beckham still held to higher standards regardless of whether he's the wide receiver or
the quarterback. He's not the quarterback.
But this is what I will say. I don't think there's much of a difference if you take your family and you go out of town and the trip doesn't get any publicity versus you went out of town.
I agree with that.
With a girlfriend or whatever.
I guess what I'm trying to say is
they could very well have done that.
Steve Smith said it perfectly. Care less about your brand and care more about your company. Company being the New York Giants. I mean, that picture, like the caller before me said, that picture didn't need to come out. Nobody needed to know about that Miami trip.
That's fair.
But because you care about what people think about you and you want to be in the limelight all the time, that picture has to get posted. I mean, you know, like, maybe it's just because I'm a guy fan, but I don't want to see you without your shirt on.
Ken,
I can care less what you look like without
your shirt on. Ken, let me just say this.
I want you to play football.
If I were the head coach, I'd prefer that the picture wasn't posted, and I would prefer that the guys maybe didn't go. But I'm going to tell you, I know for a fact, many Giants players who went out of town or spent their days off during the 2011 Super Bowl season, and it was never publicized because the media didn't get their hands on it, and it didn't go on Twitter, and it didn't go on Instagram,
yeah.
And several of those guys were key players and starters on that team, and the Giants won a Super Bowl. Now, if I went and exposed those guys and told you who some of those guys were, you would probably say to yourself, oh, wow, I can't believe it. Okay,
yeah,
but it happened.
Nobody knows about
well,
that.
And
Odell
that's,
Beckham made sure of it that everybody
well,
knew about this.
That's because the Twitter and the Instagram
of
thing
course.
Is
it's
very
a different
evil.
Time.
That's
yeah,
why. It's a
course.
Different time.
Everybody's got an agenda. And Ken, here's the other thing. You know, I mean, I understand we put athletes on pedestals and we put them in different categories. At the end of the day, you know, they have faults and they have issues just like the rest of us. But I think it's also important to note that you can't live in a bubble, whether you're an athlete, whether you're a normal human being. And I think that we have to at least look at it through that lens. If a player has a day off, while they should be, yes, focusing on the playbook and a fan can see it that way, they're also entitled to go out and live their life. I don't think that's a crime in the big picture perspective. And I don't care whether it's a Giant, it's a Cowboy, it's a Packer. To me, it doesn't really make a difference. You can't expect them to live in a bubble.
Ken.
We don't expect to do the same
thing. You know
thing.
What? Honestly, social media is here to stay. We're going to have to live with it. There are enough of things in that game that should make you sick. Besides thinking about some Miami boat trip,
sick.
Okay?
Yeah, the Hail Mary made me break a mirror in my apartment. By
I'm sorry. I hope
drugs.
You didn't cut yourself. Look, call us again some other time, Ken. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, Ken. Appreciate
Take
it.
Take care.
Have a good one.
You got it. Thanks for chiming in. Let's hear from Mark in Chicago. Mark, what's happening?
Hey, guys. How you doing? I didn't break any mirrors over the
weekend.
Well,
that's good to hear.
So.
Okay.
That's
anyway,
good to hear, Mark.
You know, I just want to say I'm actually pretty satisfied with the season. You know, obviously, we're disappointed with the ultimate ending, but as Paul can attest, you know, we went through 17 years of lousy football from 64 to 81, and you know the last few years were disappointing, but man, I'm really happy. I think we had a great year. So
11 wins,
yeah.
And it was unexpected by most. I don't think too many people thought after the Giants season last year that the turnaround would be as significant as it was. And let me tell you something. There's a lot to be thankful for about this year. I was talking to a season ticket holder the other day, and I said, let me rattle off a couple things that probably brought smiles to your faces. 2 wins over Dallas. 6-game winning streak. 6 fourth-quarter game-winning drives engineered by Eli Manning, second only to Matt Stafford of the Lions this season.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All good things. 5 guys named to the All-Pro team, whether first or second team. A bunch of young guys who emerged and showed that they can be a big part of what this team is going to do next season. If those things didn't make you smile this year, then I don't know what you were watching.
Yeah, well, it made me smile. So, anyway, I have a few questions about the game, and then I just want to make a few points about McAdoo and his coaching style. Brad Wing was obviously a big disappointment. Do you think it was because of his kicking style and the Australian kicking style not being suited to cold weather, or was he just unaccustomed to the cold weather, or did he just have a bad game?
I would like him to ask Jeff Fiegels that the next time he's on the show. Do you know when Fiegs is in again?
Jeff's going to be in on Friday. Yeah, Jeff would probably provide a lot more insight.
I don't want to take a guess on that.
Yeah, I know I tried to get some insight out of Jeff in the pregame show. We didn't have much time to do it on the air, but off the air, he did indicate to me that weather, because of how hard the football becomes, certainly impacts the kicking game. But I don't want to say that was definitely to explain why Brad Wing, you know, had some issues. I think Jeff maybe could provide more from his experience, because the man did kick in even more brutal weather in 2007.
And believe me,
right. Yeah,
the coverage teams did not hold up their end of the bargain.
No doubt. The Packers had a lot of big returns in that game, too.
Yep.
So it was the combination of the punting and the miscues in terms of the coverage.
And
no
unfortunately, a weak kickoff, too, after the 14-13 King touchdown, that weak kickoff and ensuing kickoff return, which allowed Rodgers to then go on a three-play touchdown drive, crippling drive against the Giants.
Yeah, it was the field position, too. But, Mark, I think that's a good question for Jeff when he's
Friday. Check back with him Friday.
And I'll even ask him, you know, if he doesn't address it on the air, that we can at least get that answer off on Twitter, because it's a very good question. And certainly, did you have something else that you wanted to add about McAdoo, Mark?
Yeah,
I know.
Well, there is, but I wanted to ask a question. I do want to talk about McAdoo, but I have one other question about the game. When Leon Hall hit Jordy Nelson and it ended up cracking his ribs, the Fox crew really criticized him, saying he was hitting a defenseless receiver, I think because he led with his head. To me, that was a stick-and-tackle kind of play. I didn't see that as a defenseless receiver play. Did you?
I don't remember anybody at Lambeau criticizing that play at all. You're telling me the TV crew did? When I look at the cut-ups after the game and stuff, I'm looking at stuff without sound on. So I was unaware that they were critical of it. I certainly don't believe anybody did think it was an issue. Did Mike Pereira come out and say that?
Yeah, absolutely.
He did.
They even brought him in, and he said he'd be getting a letter from the league office
Interesting.
The next day.
I'll look at it again. I didn't think so at the time.
Yeah, I didn't either. The thing about McAdoo, I called once before, and I just said I don't really think that McAdoo – has in his DNA to really establish a running game. You know, I look at his play calling. I think he's very predictable. I think when things come up to be questioned, do I run or I pass, his first instinct is to pass. And let me give you a couple examples. In the Philadelphia game, first play of the game, we come out, run 6 yards, second and four, he passes the ball. Okay, that's one situation. In the second half, there was a play where we threw an out to Cruz on first down, 6 yards, second and four, he passes the ball. I would bet that if you went back and looked at his percentages of passing on second and short, third and short, I would bet it's well over 50% that he decides to pass. And I just think that, you know, the situation we had with Will Johnson going down and Nikita Whitlock going down, we didn't have a fullback, and he was relying on people like Larry Donnell and Will Tye to block, and they just couldn't do it. And the thing about, you know, we had Brent Jones in the first game. He lined up in the backfield and, you know, did some key blocks when we, you know, had that long drive at the end of the game. I don't think he ever went back to it.
He didn't know. Brent Jones was just using
it. There were injuries and things like that, but he didn't go back to it ever again.
Well, and I think part of that also, if you recall, was Brett Jones had to move to guard because of some of the injuries to Justin Pugh. So that took away, in the early stages of the season, some of the flexibility that they could throw out there. But you are right. In Dallas, they did bring him in as a fullback. He actually helped put together that four-minute drive that milked a lot of the clock. Dallas still got the ball back, but they seemed to be productive on the ground when he was in. And then you had some injuries to the offensive line. Brett Jones was needed. Then remember, Brett Jones got hurt himself.
Right.
So then he was taken out.
He played in 14 games.
He did, but he was also not 100% throughout the course of the remainder. So I think that impacted how they utilized personnel. And, you know, we started off at the beginning of the show. Jerry Reese did address, you know, why another fullback wasn't brought onto the roster. They just didn't think that the fullback was going to be utilized enough to warrant the spot on the 53-man roster. But that still could be something that they'll look at this offseason. And remember, Will Johnson, as we also noted, is still on the roster. And the hope is he'll stay healthy and perhaps have an opportunity to compete for a roster spot.
You know, once you set your roster and you know where your top skill position guys are, and what I heard during the season a lot from the coaching staff was, well, the three wide receivers are among our best skill position guys, so we got to get them on the field as much as possible, and you got to play to your strengths. What was the situation you were asking? I have the breakdown of all the percentages. Second and two, was that what you were asking about?
He was talking about third and short.
Third and short? All right, hold on a second.
There were several second and four.
All right, third and short. Third and one, the Giants only passed the ball 35% of the time. On third and two this year, it was up to 60%. On third and three this year, it was up to 89%.
What about second and short?
Second and short, it would have been second and one, 36%. Second and two, 62%. Second and three, 47%.
I think he's just very predictable. Let me just make a couple points, and I'll get off the air. One is, if you want to see how to use a fullback effectively, look what Green Bay did with Ripkowski. He only had a few plays, scored a touchdown, got a key first down. You can be very effective with your fullback if you're creative enough.
Well, and Green Bay also used John Kuhn also. You know, Green Bay has a history with the fullback. Let's not forget.
Can't wait to see Will Johnson next year. Thanks for calling.
All right, thanks.
Take care.
You got it, Mark. Thanks so much for weighing in. Let's hit up Mike in Pennsylvania. Mike, what's happening?
Hey, how's it going, guys? First-time caller.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for being aboard. What do you got, Mike?
Well, first off, I want to thank the entire staff. You guys do a great job every day. I listen.
Appreciate that.
Particularly, I listen to you guys on deployment in the military. And nothing makes a deployment go by faster than, well, good football talks.
Thank you for your service. We appreciate that very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Second, I've heard a lot of talk about tight ends in the last few days, and I'm wondering, what's your take on Jarrell Adams? How is he developing, and what kind of role do you see him in the future?
To me, I see Jarrell Adams as number two or number three on the depth chart next season after Will Johnson, because Will Johnson's going to be my starter if it's me. That's just me now. Again, I'm not speaking for Coach McAdoo or for Jerry Reese, but I think Will Johnson's the starter, and Jarrell Adams is number two or number three, depending upon what style of offense you're going to use, his development and progress. He was a very raw player this year. And then, of course, what other tight end is on your roster, whether it's Danelle or whether it's Will Ty or whether somebody else comes into the mix. You have to look at their skill sets and say, okay, maybe in certain matchups, so-and-so's number two and so-and-so's number three, and then maybe switch them depending upon what your game plan is that week. But I do think it's Johnson number one, and Adams will be on this team, I think, as a two or a three.
Okay. And what's, in your opinion, what should be the biggest priority as far as an off-season move? And I'll take it off the air.
All right, Mike, thanks so much for weighing in. Once again, thanks for your service. I think tight end is a position that they could certainly look to perhaps bring in some competition on that front. I don't think that would necessarily hurt them to add some depth. You know, offensive line competition, too, would be another one.
See, to me, that's the key. If Jerry Reese is talking about the potential of moving Flowers, then that means you've got to find a stud left tackle. Otherwise, Flowers can't move, because there's no one else on this team who really should start at left tackle ahead of him. He's the best left tackle option they have. So if you want to even think about moving Eric Flowers, you better get yourself a stud left tackle. I mean, that to me, that's where it starts.
Well, whether it be through free agency, whether it be through the draft, whether it be through a trade, you do have a few different options if you did want to bring in some other personnel. And remember, there's also some free agents on the depth chart of the offensive line. Marshall Newhouse is a free agent. So forget just the starters. They may, depending on what they choose to do, they're going to have to bring in some depth in case guys go down with injury and so forth, too. That's another thing they're going to have to look at with respect to the offensive line. We've got Robin in Atlanta. Robin, welcome to the program. What do you have?
Hey, guys. How you guys doing?
Hello, Robin.
Thanks for taking my call, man.
You got it. Thanks for making it.
I just got a few things. I think there was a few calls ago when about the Jordy Nelson hit. I heard the same thing from the commentators, too. They said that was like a dirty hit that he put on Jordy Nelson.
And you're agreeing or disagreeing?
I disagree, because he kind of leaned in with his hand, too, and then it kind of forced him with the head and the hands at the same time. But he leaned in with both hands, try to force him out of bounds if he do catch the ball. So that was, my take on it.
Well, neither of us heard the television broadcast. I mean, I was busy on the radio, and you heard Paul saying that he was watching it without the volume. So it's hard for us to comment because neither of us really heard what the commentators had to say. I know that usually it's not until the end of the week, and I'm bringing up the replay right now. I mean, it doesn't look like a dirty play, Paul, no matter how I look at it, no matter what angle. It's unfortunate that Jordy Nelson got hurt. But
well,
I guess
that is a sideline angle we're getting, not an end zone shot. That's a sideline shot, and it doesn't look like it's a problem.
It doesn't. Well, we're going to see another angle here as it comes up through the replay. But what I was going to say is the league doesn't announce fines or anything until the end of the week. So we're not going to know whether or not the league comes down on anybody until this Friday when the whole week goes by. But that's another angle. I don't know if that gives you a better perspective, Paul.
I'm still not thinking that it's a dirty hit.
Neither am I. I mean, I think it's Nelson on the sideline, Giants trying to at least push him out of bounds and prevent him from making the catch. It didn't appear dirty, but the league, like I said, is not going to issue anything until the end of the week. So we're not going to know whether or not the league viewed it as a dirty play or it warranted a fine, because those don't come out until Friday.
And then on the second field goal we scored on that play, when we, the first three downs, we threw the ball. And we were out there, you know, 15-yard line. I don't understand why throw the ball on three downs, three straight downs.
You're talking about the first. I lost you. Which possession are we talking about here, Robin, in the game?
The second time they scored a field goal.
The second time, so to make it 6-0, you're talking about. All right, no, I just want to see what
it's
the,
all
what the
blended
drive
in.
Was.
To be perfectly frank with you, by this point, I got to go back and pull out my notes.
So the one that made it 6-0 here. Let me bring up the play by play. So your point is, you felt that they were too pass happy on that drive. Is that your point?
Yeah, they were too pass happy. That's when, you know, I mean, all the pass, Eli was throwing the ball real good, and that's when we should have just hit them with the run. You know, get them off the game, because they all dropped back.
Well,
you know, because they knew we were just passing all the time.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Giants have the ball.
Start at their own 8.
You got a pass to Beckham for 2. Jennings 11 for a run. Mm-hmm. Tie 51 yards on the seam. Cruz 6 yards on an out. Incompletion to Beckham, which we all know about. Then you get a tip ball at the line of scrimmage on 3rd and 4 from the 22. And then Gold hits the field goal. I don't know. That didn't necessarily seem like a horrible series to me.
I mean, they were actually doing most of their damage through the air. You can make that point, Robin. I mean, the 51-yard pass play to Will Tye, I mean, that helped them march down the field. They did have the 11-yard run with Rashad Jennings, but I don't think it was really the play calling. It was just the lack of execution and the receivers not hauling in the passes that Manning was throwing that stalled most of these drives. So, I mean, it's hard to use that as an example of, you know, maybe they should have gone in with a different strategy.
No, I'm just saying, like, they could at least, you know, run it maybe one time and see what, because, you know, like, they knew we were passing all the time. So you got to kind of catch them off guard. I say if you run it, try a run, maybe we pick up maybe 4 or 5 yards, and then you don't know
what
happened.
Here's what I'm going to tell you. Of all the domino effect types of things that went bad for the Giants in that game, the play selection on that series would not be one that I would put into that category. There were so many other more specific instances where the Giants, you know, basically kicked themselves in the pants that I would point to before I even got to what you're suggesting.
And, Robin, I think you'd make a stronger case if, you know, Eli Manning's throwing into double or triple coverage.
Or if he had a bad game, period.
Correct.
Eli was good.
Exactly. I mean, his throws were on the mark, and more often than not, the receivers had a chance to go up and make a play if it was man-to-man coverage or whatever it may be, and the receivers didn't bring it in. So, like I said, I think if he's making some questionable throws, double, triple coverage, then maybe you say, all right, maybe try to free things up a little bit with the ground game. But that drive, I mean, he had a lot of favorable opportunities down the field. Just the plays weren't made from an execution standpoint.
Okay. And then I just got one thing about the I think it was the fumble.
The fumble with the Paul Perkins play. Okay.
That Eli threw the pass.
Yeah, and then Paul Perkins didn't run to get it because
Matthews pushed out of the way and
exactly.
They picked up the ball.
Yeah.
And Matthews picked up the ball. But some of the things, like, I don't understand, you know, like, even though, you know, you're a football player, all these, like, little things are, like, fundamental. You learn that from the beginning.
All I will say is, all I will say is, he's a rookie. It doesn't excuse it. It doesn't excuse it in any way. He's a rookie. He's got to learn from that mistake. I don't know if he heard a whistle. Maybe he. I didn't talk to Paul about it. Maybe he thought he did hear a whistle. But as you know, play through every play. Never anticipate or assume that the referee either blew the whistle or that he saw what you thought you saw. Maybe he thought the ball was incomplete. It doesn't matter. You got to follow it through. It's a rookie mistake. But again, that didn't cost the Giants the game.
Yeah, it was so – and Paul and I spoke about this on Monday. That happened so late in the contest, Robin, in the big picture of things. Whether they recovered or not, I really don't think that changes the outcome. All right,
okay.
So we appreciate the phone call, Robin. Thanks so much for chiming in. And we do appreciate all the phone calls, all the tweets over the course of the program. We'll answer all of your other questions off the air when we have a chance. And Big Blue Kickoff Live with you each and every weekday for the remainder of the week at noon Eastern. For Paul Dottino, I'm Lance Meadow. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday right here on Giants.com.